Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Lee Chin, Associate Professor in the University of North Carolina's Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine and Director of the McAllister Heart Institute, about the work she's doing to give diseased heart tissue new life. Such an important topic for so many hundreds of millions of people around the world who suffer from heart disease. And too frequently after heart attacks, people have scar tissue in their hearts, and that scar tissue can lead to heart failure. And Dr. Chin is really working on research to help reverse this problem and maybe have new hope for millions of people. Looking forward to that conversation. First, though, let's dive right into some research that matters. And the very first research that matters, that came out of the University of North Carolina's Limeburger Comprehensive Cancer Center, is about research trials in which patients who participate in these trials are reporting side effects. We all know when you take a medication, you may suffer a side effect, and the doctor may say, you know, this particular antibiotic may cause nausea, it may cause diarrhea, you could be allergic to it, and if you have those experiences, you would probably report them to the doctor. But what if you have other experiences, such as you get a bad taste in your mouth? Would you tell the doctor about that? Well, this research actually looks in the clinical trials, and this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Informatics Association. And Dr. Chung and her colleagues actually did studies where they gave patients the options for presenting their own, whatever they found, you know, kind of an open-ended fill in the blank of what you experience versus a drop-down menu where you have to kind of pick and choose. And what they really found is it really does make a difference. And so many patients were willing to report additional symptoms when they were given kind of an open-ended, and that almost 60% of patients entered additional information. The majority were from these drop-down entries, but there was a substantial minority that were these free text issues, things like problems with tasting foods and drinks, spasms in the muscles, headaches, nosebleeds, dry mouth, fatigue, difficulty sleeping, numbness and tingling. These are things that, you know, maybe when the drug is out and you have people haven't reported it, that may not be a problem. But what if the drug is new on the market and it's in research trials? These are things that you may not have gotten already. So it really suggests that this is an important area. I think the take home is that also that patients need to be willing to say what their experience is. You don't want to be fearful that, oh, you may get kicked out of the trial if you don't report these things, but that it actually, we don't want to bias you into what you may experience. And I think reporting what you experience, hopefully is more good than bad, but this sort of thing would really make a difference. The next research that matters is making a difference. It's research that we've talked about on the show before, and it's the relationship between the vaccinations, particularly the measles vaccination, and the lack of any proof of autism. It seems strange that we actually have to debunk a myth, and this is one that's so critical now because we've seen dramatic increases, epidemics of measles that are occurring in different locations across the United States, including New York City. And majority in these are in people who are unvaccinated, and yet they're coming down now with epidemics of measles. And this research that is kind of in the same group that published a study in 2002 among over 500,000 Danish children in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed there was no relationship between the vaccination and the measles. And this is additional research. They followed 657 Danish children this time born between 1999 and 2010, and this is in the Annals of Internal Medicine, showing no relationship between increased risk for autism, doesn't trigger autism in children who may be susceptible to autism, and it was not associated with any grouping of autism cases after vaccination. But yet we do know that a 5% reduction in vaccination triples measles cases. So no relationship between the vaccine and autism, yet reduction in vaccination is clearly related to measles. Time to move on. This does not cause this problem. We need to have our kids vaccinated against measles. New development for our next Research That Matters has to do with depression. We know that depression is such a big, important issue in so many families and for so many listeners. We also know that for many, the drugs that are available may not be fully effective. And so up to a third of people may still suffer from depression, recurrent depression, depression that is not responsive to existing therapies. And this is a novel treatment called S-ketamine. It's kind of an analog of a medicine called a component of ketamine, which was approved previously as kind of an anesthetic, pain-relieving, and once was a popular party drug called Special K. This new drug is a nasal spray, and it acts within hours, not within weeks. As we typically say, between 3 and 6 weeks, the drugs might be useful for current antidepressants. And it may be appropriate for up to 5 million people in the United States with major depressive disorder who haven't been helped by current treatments. And because it acts quickly, it's being given only in doctors' offices who are specially trained to give this particular medication. And one of the concerns is that this could have potential side effects that therefore are being followed closely. We want to make sure that it's not going to be used and abused by people trying to use it for other reasons. And we also have to understand that currently this drug will probably be very expensive, up to $5,000 in the first month and a couple thousand dollars thereafter. We expect insurance will cover for those who have insurance, or at least the great majority of it. But it's still, I think, exciting for many people. I think I saw one person said, "This offers hope in capital letters." Certainly something worth thinking about there for some people. Our next Research That Matters really is about a prescription for more vegetables and fruits. Yes, you heard it here, a prescription for more vegetables and fruits. And could you imagine that you came into your doctor's office and they said, "Well, I'm going to give you a choice here. I've got a drug that may give you a 15% improvement, but I can also give you more vegetables and fruits that might get you to the same place." This was published in the journal PLOS Plus Medicine, and it was following adults between the ages of 35 and 80 who enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid, and it created two scenarios in which those on Medicare and Medicaid, if it covered the cost of 30% of fruits and vegetables for people at high risk for heart disease, and the other in which it covered fruits, vegetables, seafood, whole grains, plant oils, and other healthy foods. So maybe rather than just only medicines, also covering things that could reverse and treat and help these conditions. And it showed that with the subsidies, people rely less on the medicines and going into the healthcare system. And the first scenario could prevent 1.9 million heart attacks and 350,000 deaths and cut healthcare costs by $40 billion. In the expanded scenario, it could prevent 3 million cardiovascular heart attacks, 620,000 deaths, and 120,000 cases of diabetes. Cost-effective at 5 years and highly cost-effective at 10 and 20 years over a lifetime. This deserves a lot more publicity, a lot more thought. We're going to ask our health science librarians to put a link up to this study, encourage our listeners to look at it, because ultimately, this may be less side effects and equally good outcomes. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Li Chen, associate professor in the University of North Carolina, about the research she's doing that gives diseased heart tissue new life. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Lee Chen, Associate Professor in the University of North Carolina's Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine and Director of the McAllister Heart Institute, about her research on giving diseased heart tissue new life. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Chen.
Good to see you.
You know, we're really excited to have you here. This is such an interesting topic that I think anyone who has ever had any relative that's had heart disease should be interested in.
Yes, I definitely.
And that probably means just about everyone.
A lot of people.
It's almost universal within families.
Yes.
I think if you live maybe not back in the Stone Age, but certainly in the Bronze Age and subsequently. But, you know, first, before we get into your research, I'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in a career in science? Did you just know from the age of three on you were going to be a research scientist, a famous research scientist?
No, not at all. So I think that's really from my one of my classes in college. So I took a developmental biology class when I was in college, maybe during my third year. And I was really fascinated about the early factors that have been discovered using model organisms, such as like fruit flies, C. elegans, mouse, and others, to discover the fundamental events. And one example is like the Tin Man story. And I always tell people.
The Tin Man story.
Yeah.
This is not, is this the Tin Man from Wizard of the Oz?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So, okay, the Tin Man story coming from later on who became my PhD mentor. And he actually discovered a gene during early stage of his career. And that gene was expressed in the heart of the fruit fly. And mutation of that caused a no heart phenotype in the fly. And he named the gene Tin Man because of the character in Wizard of Oz. I think it's a fascinating name and people will remember that. Not only because of that, because later on, based on that finding, and people identify the homolog, the corresponding gene in human, and the mutation of which caused the heart disease.
Wow.
And that was a really nice, like a fiction story. And it was published by different journals and educationally to general public as well. And I found so fascinating. And at that time, I was in China and I was wondering, you know, what I should do after graduation. And if I go to the like grad school for next level education, you know, what major I should consider. And I was very fascinated by that story. And I applied to the university where Ralph Wadamer, you know, they call him father of Tin Man. And I was so fortunate and I got admitted to University of Michigan and I actually rotated in his lab and finally get admitted to join his lab.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That must have been very exciting for you.
Yes. Yes.
To be the father of Tin Man and be a granddaughter of Tin Man.
Right. That's why later on when I share the story, especially like after so many years working on heart, and people start to joke around and call me like Dorothy.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah,
really?
Because that's the character in the story.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we're going to be off to the Wizard of Oz, but I do suspect that a lot of the things we talk about today, 20 years ago, would have been Oz-like. They would have been things that you can't really imagine possibilities. And I'm wondering, as a young teenager and then getting exposed into science and to biology and the heart, did you have a sense of where the gaps in research were? Because I think sometimes people think everything's already been decided, everything's already been discovered. Where did you begin to understand and learn that there was more that we didn't know than what we do know?
That's a very interesting question. And I actually feel the more we start to do research and the more we find out we know so little. And when I was a student and I thought, oh, a lot of questions we already know the answer. And we thought, oh, a lot of disease already have the therapy and many diseases can be cured. But now, after that many years training and after doing research by myself and my team, I figure out, you know, especially for heart disease, it's not being cured at all. And many heart diseases have no good solutions yet. And the doctors trying so hard to help the patients, you know, extend life and improve their life quality. But I don't think disease has been cured.
Let's talk about an example of one cardiac disease that's still a major concern, maybe an area of your research. And then also, is there an area where you think, you know, this was the way we understood it at one time, and yet it's changed now, maybe in your lifetime? What's an example of something that's changed?
So something has changed. Some ischemic heart disease,
so
maybe like heart failure.
Lack of blood flow to the heart, the blood vessels are closing down, not getting enough oxygen.
Exactly. For example, the atherosclerotic like plaque, when ruptured, will block the blood vessel. So then cause ischemia, lack of oxygen and lack of nutrient to the heart muscle. And the heart muscle will die, right? So at the beginning, the scar tissue will form, try to compensate the dysfunction of the heart. But later on, the heart cannot take that anymore. The heart will fail, basically stop beating, and the person will die. So in the past, when anybody has gone through heart failure, the immediate thing the relatives or people around that patient will think is to take that person to the hospital to do a surgery and to do a procedure and open the blood vessel and try to let the blood flow to go through again and hopefully can recover the muscle tissue.
That sounds like a good plan.
Right? Sounds like, okay.
Yep.
There are a couple of things. Number one, so the condition need to be identified as early as possible because there is a time window. If you miss the time window, the damage already happened. So the cells are dying and that cell can never be alive again. And the damage already formed, scar tissue start to form as well. And if you miss the time point, no matter what you do, and the heart will eventually still fail. Number two, even if you take the patient to the hospital on time, and there's still some damage happened because within like 20, 30 minutes when the clogging of the blood vessel happened, a lot of things already happened. We always call the acute response from the cell in the heart. Some of the damage, maybe most of the damage, they are permanent, irreversible. So then even the patient temporarily gets improved and the condition also gets improved. But in the long term, because of some early damage, the heart cannot perform as like normal people. And probably during their early 60s or even 50s, they have some heart condition much earlier than a healthy person.
Is our understanding that with our current technology and current medications that heart failure is inevitable for people who have heart disease? Is that pretty much the way people think about it? Or do they think, oh, we can reverse heart failure. We can prevent heart failure.
So the heart failure is the ultimate consequence for many heart diseases and conditions. From my point of view, heart failure once happened is not reversible. It's very detrimental when people have heart failure. Most likely, you know, they probably just passed away.
So once an accident in a car has happened, you really can't undo that accident.
Yes, exactly.
You can try to prevent that accident.
You can try to prevent.
Mitigate its consequences with airbags, prevent injury. But the best thing is to prevent it from occurring.
Right, exactly.
So you're trying to prevent heart failure.
Yeah.
And how do you do that?
Oh my God, that's a great question. That people always, you know, even from a scientist or maybe from just as a mom, as a wife, as a daughter, I think it's really how you have your like daily lifestyle. And your lifestyle is important, what you eat and, you know, how much you exercise. You know, people are talking about that all the time. But I think, you know, seriously, that's how you can start from the beginning to prevent heart failure.
But you're also doing, and we're going to really get into this after a break, you're doing research about trying to reprogram heart cells. Just tell us right before the break, what exactly is that?
Okay, wow. If I start with that, I'll probably talk about for more than an hour. But to keep it short, so we try to change a cell type that initially is a supporting cell in the heart. But with the injury, that supporting cell will become the scar. And we now try to convert that scar-forming supporting cell into a heart muscle cell so that the damage can be partially reversed at least. And you are changing scar tissue into healthy muscle tissue, and heart function can become better.
Wow. Well, this is where we're going to be talking. We're going to pick right up on this conversation right after we do take a short break. We're talking with Dr. Lee Chen, Associate Professor in the University of North Carolina's Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine and Director of the McAllister Heart Institute, about giving diseased heart new life. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Lee Chen, Associate Professor in the University of North Carolina's Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine and Director of the McAllister Heart Institute, about her research on giving diseased heart tissue new life. And right before the break, Dr. Chen, you were starting to talk about this process of really trying to take what could be a scar after damage and turn it into something else. In this case, maybe muscle, so that the heart may not lose its function. And I'm wondering, why is the heart different than the skin, let's say? When we cut ourselves, that just keeps regenerating, and you can't even tell most times that you've actually had a cut.
Yeah.
What's different about the skin and the heart?
Yes. So one special thing about the heart muscle in the heart is that they cannot regenerate, or they barely regenerate during adulthood. So the problem is, once the cells are dead, they're no longer to replenishing themselves. So you're losing the cells in your cardiomyocyte pool. So that's very different from the skin cell, very different from your liver cells, and also very different from the heart cell in like other vertebrate animals, such as zebrafish, such as amphibian. Their heart cells can regenerate, can continue dividing.
What is it that our heart needs to learn from our skin, and how are you going about trying to change what appears to be an intrinsic problem?
Yes. So I think the main thing is cardiomyocyte. So we call it professionally heart muscle cell. They no longer divide in adulthood.
That's just the way it is.
Yes. That's, okay. Oh yeah. We try to change that, by the way. So we can alter the cell cycle of cardiomyocytes. A lot of groups are doing, although we are not doing, we take reprogramming approach, but many other labs in the world, they're trying so hard, try to make the cardiomyocyte re-enter the cell cycle so that they can divide, especially with injury. And then the cells can replenish the cardiomyocyte pool by themselves, like fish, like amphibian, like the animals, or even like babies. Mm-hmm. So then I think when we were little, especially, in mom's womb, and our hearts still have the regenerative capacity because our cardiomyocytes are dividing. So we are learning really the biology very hard behind how cardiomyocytes divide, try to restore its division during adulthood, especially with injury.
And how do you push it to behave more, regenerate muscle? How does that process occur? Because you're trying to make that cell that's rather going to scar become active muscle again.
Oh, so that's different. Okay. So the way I talked earlier is try to make them divide. But for our reprogramming approach, we actually try to change the cell fate. So from a supporting cell that we called a cardiac fibroblast, now make them become a new cell type, cardiomyocytes. So we are changing the fate of the cell, which is completely different from make the cardiomyocyte divide again.
Ah, so you're going from different approaches to essentially alter again, though, this end path, which is the irreversible space in place.
Exactly.
And when you think about the research, and many people think about research as very molecular, but you have a goal to have this occur in humans.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yep.
How do you bridge the gap? Where are you between where you're at now and where you want to be with any of the research that you're doing? Because you're getting awards, you're getting recognition. People believe in what you're doing.
Yes. So we are working very hard with small animal models, such as rodents, and the things are working really well in mice. And the next step, we are going to take into large animal and hopefully use pig. And then there are a lot of collaboration we are developing, for example, with NC State, States because they have really great vet school. So hopefully our approach can be tested in large animal. And then later on, we can also try to do some preclinical approach and using like maybe adenovirus or other vehicles that are safer to deliver our reprogramming factors and to make the scar tissue into heart muscle tissue.
Is this in the form ultimately of a medication? Is it in the form of some sort of intravenous? How do you see this happening?
I think the first step, maybe it's a local injection or local delivery. Like use a mini pump embedded in your heart or where the scar tissue is and give the reprogramming factor at a precise time and also dosage and allow that scar tissue to heal, you know, reprogrammed into heart muscles. And of course, the future will be as simple as probably take some medicine without worrying, like embed a mini pump or, you know, do local delivery because that all will require procedures. And the future will be really take a pill. That's ideal. But I think, you know, a lot of research needs to be done before we reach that final goal.
Right, because right now the current kind of a state of the art, you know, in my family practice is when we have someone with heart failure, we want to kind of keep those heart cells operating as long as they can.
Exactly.
But we know that once you get down towards a very low amount of heart function left, the prognosis is as bad as cancer.
Yes.
And that's very, very
pretty
hard.
Pretty sad, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Now you must have, because of your success in bringing in grants and research, you must work in a laboratory.
Yes.
And you must bring now students around you, pre-doctoral and post-doctoral students, kind of like you were mm-hmm. at University of Michigan. Tell us about what that's like to have a lab of people who are really wanting in this collaborative research you're doing.
Yeah. So I think that's another major motivation for me to really work hard in lab because when I see them, almost like I see myself many years ago. And for me, you know, we are doing great science, but it's not the piece of science one lab can accomplish. It must be many labs. They all do together. And only in the end, we put all the information together, we can get the best answer. How we do that? So we have to pass our torch to the next generation. Because I benefited so much from the mentoring of my PhD mentor, my postdoc mentor, and I'm hoping to give back and hope to learn from them and also train excellent like grad student, excellent postdoctoral fellows so that they can take on and have their independent career and they can make major discoveries. And in the end, all of us can contribute to find the ideal treatment for heart disease.
So if I'm a young high school student, maybe a young college student out there listening to today's show, and I'm wondering, can I be a scientist? What do you say to that student? Because they may look at you and go, I could never be a Dorothy. You know, but they don't need to be Dorothy, right?
No, they don't.
They need to be themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I told every single person in the lab. No matter whether you're a postdoc, you're a lab manager, you're a student, or research associate, every single person contributes to every project. You know, it's like the brick in the building. And without every single brick, the building won't be there. So it's just a matter of what kind of contribution you actually did. And everything matters. If you love science, follow your passion. And eventually, what gives you the fulfillment is what you have done. It's really not like what kind of position you get or what kind of paper in the end you get. Of course, you know, if you work hard and, you know, everything turns out well, you will get your papers, you will get your independent position and et cetera, et cetera.
So you are also director of the McAllister Heart Institute. Tell us, what is the Heart Institute and what is its role vis-a-vis the bridge between perhaps clinical work and research?
Yeah. So the Heart Institute actually have both basic scientists and also clinicians, those cardiologists. So that's, I really love to be, you know, part of the leadership for McAllister Heart Institute because we have a very interdisciplinary team and that, you know, comprised of basic scientists, a clinician, and maybe epidemiologists, and also people from other institute and department. So it's a program. It's sort of virtual, but we also have our physical location in one building. But we have the faculties like coming from many different departments and centers. So that's the expertise. As long as the expertise and the research topics related to cardiovascular, so we have them in our institute. And in this way, the collaboration can happen very easily because you can go to contact those PI, you know, by the information listed on the website. And we also have like symposium, annual meeting. We always see each other, you know, chat about our science. And also we co-publish a lot. We also apply grant funding from NIH, from American Heart Association, also quite a lot. So through all these activities, bring us together to discuss about science, develop future collaborations.
It sounds like that this is Oz.
Yeah, that's right.
This is.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I think this is so important, and we need to really thank you for being our guest on Your Health, because heart disease is one of the things that bridges people around the world.
Right.
And particularly as society is living longer, it becomes a common pathway. And whether you are a researcher or a patient in China, a researcher or a patient in Chapel
Definitely.
Hill, North Carolina,
yep.
you've got the same aspirations and the same problems.
Because you always have heart disease patients around you. And so my father-in-law has pretty severe heart disease condition. And I also hear from friends, like you hear all the time. That's why it basically affects everybody's life. It's not about that patient. It's about that patient's family, friends, and the people who they love and people who love them. It's actually basically affects everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, my father also had heart attacks. And I remember he just really brought home to me the importance of really both asking good questions and really pushing science forward. So we want to thank you for pushing us forward today in the understanding of your research, Dr. Lee Chin at the University of North Carolina and McAllister Heart Institute. Thank you so much for being our guest.
You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
So this first listener says, I went to see my doctor recently and my blood pressure was high. My doctor said not to worry about it because I'm under a lot of stress right now. My brother has brain cancer, my son has depression, and I'm having my own health problems that I'm dealing with. I thought I was going to be scolded, but instead I felt supported and reaffirmed. I just wanted to share.
Well, that's important to share, and we really do appreciate that. This is such a hard situation, and I'm sorry to hear about your mm-hmm. family member with cancer and
it's a lot.
Your children and family, and, you know, we carry burdens and we don't know what the other person's carrying.
Exactly.
And to think that you're going to come into the doctor's office, which is already a stressful environment, and
exactly.
your blood pressure is not
yeah.
going to be elevated in that situation. The problem is sometimes is that if one doesn't see the whole person,
yeah.
one might focus on just one thing. You know, you may get a flag on your electronic medical record. This person's blood pressure is elevated. Put them on another medication. Well, maybe that's not the right thing to do today.
Not a very holistic approach to care there.
Right. On the other hand, I think we don't want to ignore the fact that stress can raise the blood pressure. So the person may need to have the blood pressure monitored a little more closely. And maybe we don't worry about it today, but maybe we'll come back in 3 weeks.
Check again. Yeah.
Maybe you could send me a couple blood pressure readings once a week for 3 or 4 weeks, because it may be that the stress is raising your blood pressure today, but you know what? The stress is raising your blood pressure 24 hours a day, and your blood pressure is not controlled, or you have new onset high blood pressure. That would probably still need treatment.
But even that doesn't sound like scolding, which is good. It sounds like this patient got some care that was much
yeah.
more understanding than.
Yeah, I think it's that fine line there,
yeah.
and focusing on the whole patient, as you said, the holistic
yeah.
health. Yeah. Hope that's helpful. Again, thank you for sharing. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a young woman who most people would say is obsessive and compulsive about a lot of things. I also have ADHD and I smoke. I don't know which drug or condition treats which problem, but it does seem that I rely on my medication, the nicotine from the cigarettes, and the behaviors that I have to function. I do know, however, that some of these are killing me. What should I do?
You know, I think this describes a lot of people, you know, who figure out they have different things going on in their mental and their physical health conditions, and whether the drugs that are prescribed or the drugs that are not prescribed or alcohol or marijuana for some people, you know, they're self-medicating. You have something that it's hard to focus, and so you're taking a drug for that. And then you have something that maybe isn't even being treated because maybe there's not really good medications, this obsessive-compulsive disorder. And you throw all three of those together, it suggests this is a tricky space and place. And this is where I think you need a team. I think, you know, this needs a primary care provider who really does understand you and listens and is supportive, because you do need to make some changes. You know, you do need to get off nicotine, or at least cigarettes. And you may have a non-combustible form of nicotine that wouldn't be harmful to your health, that may be more helpful. You maybe need some behavioral strategies that may could lower the medications for your ADHD, and also behavioral strategies for obsessive compulsive disorder, this CBT. Cognitive behavioral therapy could be helpful.
Yeah.
In which case you may need a therapist, maybe even a psychiatrist. That's three people right there.
But if it helps kind of unweave some of these problems that are all tangled together, it might be worth it.
Yeah. I don't think you need to do it overnight. But I think starting on a process, some people say, you know, should you tackle all these things at once or should you do them one at a time? The answer is yes.
Both of those things.
you know, yes and yes. That means we don't really say that we're not going to deal with it, because we know and we would both agree that that's not helpful. Thank you for that question. What's next, Laura?
The next question is, recently I broke out with a rash. It was all over my legs with these bright, teeny purple bumps, and I felt certain it was going to be bad news, but I didn't have any other symptoms. My doctor said it was actually called Schamberg's purpura. I don't know if I said that right, but
you got it pretty close. I'm pretty good.
Okay. But said otherwise it's totally harmless, and I just never heard of it before.
It's interesting when people come into the doctor with skin conditions. Let's face it, you think you got cancer. You know, you got something bad. You got scabies. You got something that's bad. It's going to infect other people and it's going to kill you. You know, something like that. And you want some reassurance. And luckily, this particular condition is something that can be reassuring. These little small bumps, they could be pink, they could be purple, they may not even be raised, and they're usually on the legs and lower legs, and you kind of go, oh my goodness, I'm breaking out in something, but you don't itch. You can itch a little, but usually you don't have any symptoms with this, and you just have discoloration. And it's like leakage into these teeny little blood vessels that are all over the body, and it's called Schomburg's disease, Schomburg's purpura, and it was named after J. Frank Schomburg, who described it over 120 years ago. It's actually benign. It doesn't really cause any problems. You know, it's there. It's probably not going to go away. Maybe if it itches, you could use some cortisone cream, some moisturizing cream, but it doesn't mean anything else. It's not associated with any other disease, and you're going to live a long life.
Okay.
Well, I can't guarantee that.
Well, yeah. I mean, but you're not going to suffer from the purpura.
The purpura,
purpura.
And there's, purpura is actually this discoloration. And there can be bad forms of purpura. Mm-hmm. So, but this one is not one of them. What's our very last house call, Laura?
I've had chronic pain for a long time, and I find that taking one or two Percocets a day really does allow me to function. Recently, however, when I go to the doctor, they start talking about reducing my dose and or getting me off completely. But I am not able to take ibuprofen-like drugs, and nothing else seems to work. Do you think it's okay if I continue to take the Percocet?
Well, this is one of those cases I say you really need to talk with your primary care provider, maybe the person who's giving you the medications, if it's not a primary care provider, therapist, and others, because it's a complicated question here. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we know that overdose due to opiates is such a high, significant problem for so many people. And we know that we can treat pain in non-opiate ways, and that the opiates don't relieve a lot of the pain that we think they do, at least in the clinical studies. So all those things would say maybe we shouldn't be on the opiates. On the other hand, opiates can relieve pain for some people. And if your pain is being relieved and you're not abusing it, and you're not having side effects from it, it's maybe much better for you than maybe some of the other medicines that aren't working that could be pretty significantly difficult on your kidneys or your stomach or other things. So the lower dose is better, though. So sometimes we say, well, can we cut the dose by like 25%? Maybe then we'll feel better. You know, and a lot of patients are willing to try that.
Yeah, and see if it works.
And see if it works. Staying with the patient, staying with them and letting them know that you're going to be there with them and that you will still help with their pain. I think that's important. Thank you for that question. And thank all of our listeners today for your questions and concerns. We hope we've addressed them on Your Health. You can send any question to us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family and Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Lee Chan. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.